It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. The standard chef's portrait, arms folded and a dead serious stare at the camera. This is the exact opposite of what photographer Melanie Denia does. She's after the story behind that white jacket.
You know, I sort of went into Aquavit, Marcus Samuelson. He was one of the subjects. And I said, oh, hi, so I've done a little bit of research. I know your story, which is that he was born in Africa and adopted by some Swedish people. So I was just mulling that over and thinking and thinking. And I thought, oh, he has to have a turban of smoked salmon. And I said, you know I don't know you, but would you put a smoked salmon around your head? And he's like, yes, I will. That was a perfect example of something that really made sense. I mean, it blended the African, the Swedish, the food, and the man.
Behind the scenes of chefs' photo shoots and much more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Melanie Denia photographs people, the likes of Kanye West, Mary Louise Parker, and Steve Martin. But what made her reputation in food was her star chef portraits. No classic kitchen shot for her. In her groundbreaking book, My Last Supper, with 50 chefs' pictures and what their last suppers would be, she went after the unexpected. Like Anthony Bourdain, embellished only by a huge steer's femur, and Gary Danko, buried in an Arabian Nights feast with turban and jewels. Contributor Melissa Clark wanted to know how Melanie gets those photos.
So, Melanie, what made you start photographing chefs?
I got this call in 2000 from Ruth Reichel, who was over at Gourmet magazine, and she said to me, I don't know if you're familiar with these baseball cards that we do in the magazines. Do you remember those?
I don't, no.
They were like recipe cards with famous chefs on them. And she said, I'd like you to photograph 9 chefs. And she rattled off these names like Mario Batali, Eric Repair. I hadn't heard of any of them. And she said, will you go photograph them? And I said, okay, what do you want me to do? She said, I don't care. How about that for a dream assignment?
And so how did you prepare yourself to do these shots?
I didn't. It was kind of amazing. I just walked into Babbo and I was like, hi, Mario Batali. I did a little research. You know, I knew that he cooks a lot of sausages. So I went down, you know, Ottomanelli's. I went down to Ottomanelli's and bought a huge sort of necklace of sausages and wrapped them around his neck. And what I loved about it, I did 9 chefs. And what I loved about it was, you know, I started as a celebrity photographer, a portrait photographer, and that comes with hair and makeup and publicists. And this was in 2000. So it was me and Mario and a bunch of sausages.
So I guess, is that one of the ways that it's very different from photographing celebrities?
Well, it's changed a lot. I mean, in 2000, it was a lot less of big business. It was, I sort of went into Aquavit, where Marcus Samuelson, he was one of the subjects. And I said, oh, hi, so I've done a little bit of research on you. I know your story, which is that he was born in Africa and adopted by some Swedish people. So I was just mulling that over and thinking and thinking. And I thought, oh, he has to have a turban of smoked salmon. That says it all.
A turban of smoked salmon. And did you make him put
on? We did it.
How did you do that?
Well, it was very stinky. My hands reeked for a week. But I just said, you know I don't know you, but would you put a smoked salmon around your head? And he's like, yes, I will. And he actually requested me to photograph him for years. I think that was my way in with Marcus.
Is there any analog to celebrities where you've told them to do something just as wacky, or do you have special license with the chefs?
Well, no, it just really seemed to – that was a perfect example of something that really made sense. I mean, it blended the African, the Swedish, the food, and the man. And, you know, that's all I'm doing is telling stories. I'm just trying to really sort of water it all down, uh-huh. You know, just get to the real core, the real essence. And sometimes I win and sometimes I miss. But Ruth received the pictures and said, oh my goodness, whoa, we are putting Mario Batali on the cover.
Oh my gosh, with the sausages.
So actually it wasn't. It was with a big kohlrabi because I thought when I met him, I thought, wow, he's sort of like a Roman emperor. and we have to show this big man and this big personality, and he ended up being the second man that was ever on a cover of a food magazine.
Wow.
So it was really a big deal. It was very exciting. And that was sort of the beginning of my seduction with chefs. I mean, I was sort of mesmerized by the world, and I could see that it was beginning to it was something. It was a group of people that, you know, there weren't TV shows. I mean, there was like BAM Emerald.
Oh, right, Emerald.
There, you know, Malto Mario, but it wasn't the phenomenon it is now. And I thought, there's something here.
You knew that it was bubbling.
Mm.
So how has it changed? You've been doing this for 15 years. What's it like now, especially with the younger chefs?
It's very different. It's become a bit more of a machine. Mm-hmm. I'll probably never work again after I answer this question. a bit more business. Mm-hmm. I did My Last Supper 1, and then I did a book in between. And when I started My Last Supper 2, you would think, oh, it'd be so easy. Not at all. I had publicist people I had to convince. In fact, one chef even asked me to pay him.
What?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And I remember, you know, I wanted Jean-Georges so badly, and I just could not get through to him for whatever reason. They didn't know who I was.
Right.
And this was before email, kind of, was our big way of contact. And somebody said he's required to sit at the bar at Columbus Circle at the restaurant, you know, his mm-hmm. restaurant there.
Yeah.
He's required to sit there 4 hours a week. And I was like, when? And boy, did I go and stalk him out.
Did you? And
yep.
You just went every night until you found him?
Yep.
And then did you convince him to?
I did. And well, once they're in my lair, they can't say no.
So now tell us about your book. Tell us about The Last Supper. When you wrote that book, you were asking chefs what they would eat for their last meal.
Well, I came up with the idea at my wedding. I was sitting with Anthony Bourdain, and I said, Tony, I love books, and I love the bookstore, and there are no coffee table-y books. Every chef, it's for his own. It's a Bobby Flay book. Mm-hmm. It's a Mario book. It's a Todd English book back then. I would like to really bring all these guys together. And you're not eating pig's neck sashimi for breakfast or whatever, Tony. You're eating cereal.
Right.
So I thought, if I pose this question, what would be the ultimate meal? Where would you be? What would you be drinking? Who would be your guests? Who would prepare the meal? It would force all the chefs to answer in the way they wanted to answer. So I picked 50 chefs, and I asked them all the same questions. And by the way they answered, I feel like they revealed themselves. And from there, I took a thread of the answer, which could have been, for example, Danielle said, I want to be at Versailles. And I thought, well, obviously we have to go to Versailles. So I called Versailles every single day for 6 months, and I'm not exaggerating. And finally, they said yes.
Wow.
So I created the book, and I did the interviews and the portraits. There's a recipe in the back, which I, you know, is some of them are weird. They're like sea urchin, you know, blah,
right.
blah.
Uh-huh.
And some are scrambled eggs.
So you shot in Versailles. You shot in chef's kitchens. Do you also shoot in studios? And what's easier for you, to shoot in a studio or to shoot a chef in his or her milieu?
Definitely not in a restaurant. Because they're of another mindset. I'm in the way, and they're busy, and they're not focused. That being said, for example, I shot Giorgio Locatelli from London mm-hmm. in a studio, and his Last Supper was mackerel. So I hired a food stylist to get me 700 mackerel and put them up on a wall so he could stand in front of the mackerel.
A wall of mackerel.
So that was stinky, too.
You seem to like working with smelly fish.
Yes. So it's actually more – I sort of dread the restaurant because it's busy and they're not focused. But some of the best pictures have come out of the restaurant.
Is there a new group, maybe not chefs, maybe farmers or food producers who you think you might want to photograph in a similar way?
Yes. I went last October on a real, real, real truffle hunt. And I have never done anything more difficult in my life. And it sort of was an awakening to the source of the food and how I might sit with you at dinner and they might be shaving these expensive truffles, but I have no idea how the truffles got to the table.
And that'll be your next exploration.
Yes.
Melanie, thank you so much. It was great to talk to you.
Thank you for having me.
Melanie Dunia is author of My Last Supper. Now, you can find her on Instagram at My Last Supper. Melissa Clark is a food columnist for the New York Times. And by the way, Melanie left us with a video of Melissa Clark's video version of My Last Supper. Find it on the website, splendidtable.org. We've We've been taking a look back at some of our most memorable interviews of the past 20 years. And one that we continue to think about was a conversation with chef and writer Daniel Patterson of San Francisco's Qua. We went to him to talk about the essential tools that a chef needs to have on hand. And his answer is still illuminating. Hey, Daniel, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So for you, what tops the list of your favorite tools?
My hands.
Why am I not surprised?
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. It's you can go out and you can buy any kind of high-tech tools, but at the end of the day, there's one thing that gives more information more accurately and more consistently than anything else, and that's my hands.
You know, when you watch these chef shows, all of these people are using tongs. So what's with the tongs?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, when I started working in restaurants, I thought tongs were fantastic because I'd never seen them before at home.
Uh-huh.
And went in, and everyone's using tongs. And the great thing about the tongs is that you could twirl them around on your finger and look really cool.
It's sort of the gunslinger's approach.
Exactly. I was 14 years old. You know, that looked pretty good to me.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, what I realized over time is tongs are, they're really a brutal way of handling food. They're not sensitive to the food.
Yeah.
They're kind of rough around the edges, and they tend to tear things. And you don't learn anything. So if we have a very hot piece of meat in a pan,
mm-hmm.
We use a spoon to turn it, or we use chopsticks, which have metal ends, which we got in Japan, and basically everyone around the kitchen has them. And honestly, we'll put our hands into hot pans as much as anything else.
Yeah, but you guys, I mean, you have the skins of an orange.
Oh, yeah, that's not a recommendation.
but how do you use touch? I mean, for we home cooks, how do you recommend we use our hands?
Well, a great example is, I was just talking about this with a friend of mine. They used to have all kinds of problems figuring out when a piece of meat was done. And my wife used to be the same way. She would take it out of the pan, cut it with a knife, and look at it.
Mm-hmm.
And if it wasn't done, it would go back into the pan, leaking juices. And then sometimes, if this piece of meat was really unlucky, it would come out, it would get cut again,
and then
go back in again. At which point, you know, it was kind of mangled. And eventually I showed her. I said, look, just if you feel it and you get used to what feels like rare, what feels like medium rare, then you don't have to go through that whole process. And so she, over time, learned how to touch the meat to figure out when it was done. And that there's some shorthand to that, touching the space between your thumb and your first finger.
Right.
Feels kind of like rare, and, you know, the tip of your nose is I forget what it is, medium well or something. A friend, I never learned this. A friend of mine told me, and I put it in a story I wrote one time, and then, of course, promptly forgot it the next minute.
Yeah, but I have to tell you, I remember it because I read that story. The tip of your nose, you said, was medium. Your earlobe was rare. Notice how this stuck. Your earlobe was rare. Medium was your nose, and your chin was well done.
Yeah, that
but
sounds right.
Does that apply to everything? I mean, like from a chicken breast to a piece of fish?
No, it's more kind of red meat steak.
Yeah.
You know, the information that's so important in terms of touch is like tossing a salad. So using tongs to toss a salad, what happens is the metal bruises the leaves,
mm-hmm.
and there is nothing that is better suited to toss a salad than your hands, which are going to be soft, gentle, and they're going to mix the leaves completely. And you're going to be able to feel when they're coated just right.
Huh.
And, you know, the tongs, they're never going to tell you when the leaves are coated. And then, you know, the other thing is for seasoning. So a lot of times people will use spoons and kind of sprinkle things. We use our hands because the way that the salt falls out of our hands is much more even and much more controllable.
Yeah, and the other thing is that this gives you a connection to your food.
Oh, absolutely. And I think the thing about the tongs, too, is it's, you know, you're outside in the backyard and you're grilling, and they're perfectly fine. But they're, in a way, kind of symptomatic to me of a larger remove from our food that's happened over the last 40 or 50 years. And people have gotten afraid to engage with what they're eating.
Mm.
And there's something about the tactile interaction between your food and touching it that leads to kind of a deeper sensitivity. And in a way, kind of brings you closer to what you're cooking.
Yeah. Daniel, thank you.
Well, thank you so much.
Daniel Patterson is chef of the award-winning Qua in San Francisco. Now, you can use your hands to try out this recipe for summer greens and peach salad. Find it at splendidtable.org. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. African food. You hear that expression all the time, yet it's like saying European food. It doesn't exist. Each African country is a world and a cuisine unto itself. One vivid example is Senegal. This is West Africa, and the country that juts out into the Atlantic. For chef and activist Pierre Tcham, it's his homeland. His first book paid tribute to his roots, his family's food. Now he's gone to his country's culinary roots and their stories in his latest book, Senegal, Modern Senegalese Recipes from the Source to the Bowl. Pierre, it's great to have you back again.
It's great to be here, Lynn.
Pierre, if we've never seen Senegal, set the scene for us. What are the flavors, the ingredients, the aromas?
Well, Senegal, as you said, it is the most Western country in Africa. It's like in the coast of the Atlantic Ocean. It's surrounding us pretty much. The city where I grew up is a peninsula. So lots of seafood. You have to expect the smells of the ocean. You have to also expect the funky smell of fermentation. That's something that's big in our cuisine. We ferment conch. You have smoking as well and the chars of grilling. You have a lot of fruitiness in our cuisine, the spices of Scotch bonnet. The healthy aspect is also very, very, very much part of our cuisine. Freshness, fresh vegetables, lots of leafy greens, rice, that's the most common grain. But you also have other grains like fonio, millet, sorghum that comes more in the countryside when you go down south Senegal. And the climate also influences the cuisine. Senegal is south of the Sahara Desert, so you have a semi-desertic country in the north. And further you go south, you have more like a tropical, lush area. And both cuisines are different. You know, the south has more like the okra, you know, coconut comes out in the menu.
Uh-huh. So when you go home to Senegal, what is the first thing you want to eat?
Cheboujan.
Say that again.
Cheboujan. That's the national dish. That's the dish you would expect to see pretty much on a daily basis for lunch. It's a very complex dish that the translation of the name doesn't really do it justice. It's a word in Wolof that translates fish and rice. But cheboujan is so much more than that. It's our paella in a way. You know, it's rice that's cooked in a tomato broth. The broth has been enriched with the fish. The fish is cooked in that broth with the tomato and vegetables. And remember I mentioned the funky agent as well.
The fermentation.
Fermented conch. You have dried fish. All that is in the broth with the vegetables. The vegetables could be as diverse as eggplants, yucca, sweet potatoes, okra. it's a very rich broth. And then once all those are cooked, they're scooped out and put on the side, and then the rice is cooked inside the broth. And that color is red because of the rich tomato broth. So the rice comes out red. And the most important thing in the cheboujan for me is the crust at the bottom of the pot. The rice forming a crust. Like I think some people call it sokorat, but we call it khogn. And that brings another texture when you eat the rice and you have that crunchiness of the crust. And I forgot to mention that fish is stuffed with a mixture that we call ruff. And that mixture is made out of parsley and Scotch bonnet and scallions and garlic and all pounded together. And, you know, you slit in the flesh of the fish and you stuff that mixture. And it, so it has these surprising bites of heat that comes once in a while as you eat it. And it just blends wonderfully.
Oh, it sounds like flavor upon flavor upon flavor.
Indeed.
And shadings. And
yes.
Is there the other end of the spectrum in Senegalese food of a very simple you know, very direct flavors as well?
Oh, yes, yes. Actually, that reminds me of one dish from the South. It's very simple. We call it yassa. And yassa has only really three ingredients. It's lots of onions that have been cooked slowly with lime juice and grilled either fish or chicken. The chicken or the fish has been marinated in that same lime flavor, lime and garlic and thyme, and then marinated for some time, overnight ideally, if it's meat. And then you grill it on a wood-burning stove, and you serve it over rice. The onions, remember, have been cooked so slowly, and it has the lime, but it's cooking so slowly that it tends to caramelize, so it has a sweetness that comes out. So you have lots of onion that makes the sauce of this dish over the chicken and simple rice. So it's like fruity flavor from the lime, and the sweetness of the onion, and the char from the wood-burning grill. Comfort food, simple. Another dish too, it's made out of peanut sauce, you know, cooked slowly. And most of the time it's lamb. That's my favorite. The lamb is cooked slowly in that peanut sauce. So you have like this rich and thick peanut sauce. It comes on the side with vegetables. And also you can serve it again over grains like millet, fonio, or rice.
This sounds so delicious. One thing you've mentioned a couple of times now, fonio.
Mm.
Tell me about fonio.
Well, fonio is an ancient grain. Actually, it's a grain that's been cultivated for thousands of years in Africa, and it's suspected to be the oldest cultivated grain in Africa.
Hmm.
Back in the days before colonial times, fonio was widespread. As a matter of fact, it's been found, fonio, by archaeologists in burial ground in ancient Egypt.
Oh,
to tell you how important that grain was in Mali, the country that borders Senegal. They have a mythology. Fonio is the seed of the universe. Just these little stories to tell you how important fonio has been in our culture. It's this tiny little grain that looks like sand. It's gluten-free. It's rich in protein. For me, the most important part is delicious. It's very versatile. I make so many different recipes out of fonio. I use it to substitute any grains, or I make a salad out of it with like lots of citrus and herbs like parsley, and I use nuts in it, and I use sometimes fruits like mangoes and cucumber and tomatoes. I make with flour. I make some breads with it. You can have some great gluten-free pastries with it as well. Another important aspect of fonio is drought resistant. It grows in the harshest conditions, you know, again, Senegal is semi-desertic. So you see fonio could be growing in the almost sandy ground. It matures in 2 months, one of the fastest maturing grain.
Wow. I noticed from the recipes, it cooks in like 15 or 20 minutes also.
Yes, exactly. And there's actually a Bambara saying, fonio never embarrasses the cook. So that's to tell you how it's so easy to cook. One cup of fonio, one cup of water, and you have your recipe down.
In a conversation that we had when we were talking about your first book several years ago, you mentioned something that was very interesting to me. You said Africa in its native plants and the foods that were traditional before foreigners came could feed itself so well, but that people have turned away from it. And it's fonio, it sounds like fonio is one of the keys to that.
Absolutely. Fonio is one of the keys to that, and that's why I'm championing it. Indeed, Africa has been feeding itself before colonial times, and it's a continent that has the most amount of arable land. I mean, it's one of the most fertile land to begin with. The tragedy of colonialism is that we were led to believe, you know, that everything that comes from the West was better. And we were brainwashed this way, that we looked down at what we had.
Mm-hmm.
The Senegal is a very good example. To have fonio in Senegal, you have to go in the countryside. You would have difficulties finding restaurants in Dakar, in the city, that serves fonio because, you know, it's not Western enough, you know. We prefer to have our baguette that's made out of wheat, you know. Every street corner of Dakar, or of Senegal for that matter, sell the best baguette. I mean, great baguette, just like in Paris, you know, because this was what we were looking up to, you know. But our own products, such as fonio or even broken rice, the rice that we use to make the Chebujan national dish.
Yes.
You know, how we got to be using broken rice is because that broken rice was imported to Senegal from Indochina at the time, which became Vietnam. Indochina was part of the French colonial empire. And the French brought this broken rice, which really was the overprocessed rice that the Vietnamese would throw away after they processed the rice.
Right.
The French would send it to Senegal because they wanted our farmers to be just busy growing peanuts at the time. That was a cash crop for the French industries. So the broken rice became the grain that was promoted by the colonials, and the Senegalese embraced it like we embrace many things. And we make great things with that broken rice. We make this great dish with it. But we look down at our own type of rice, because we do have a type of rice in the south of Senegal, which is where my family is originally from, in Casamance. There's a typical rice called Oriza Glaberima. That's a different kind of rice than the one that comes from Southeast Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the rice that was, funny enough, exported from Senegal and Sierra Leone and Guinea to the Americas during the slave trade. So this rice came from Senegal. The rice we looked down upon came from Senegal and went to the Americas and became an important crop. You know, in the Carolinas, it was so important that it was nicknamed the Carolina Gold. You see the irony?
That was in the 1700s and 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
From what I understand, the single most expensive rice in the United States, and foreign countries paid huge amounts of money to get their hands on it. The irony of that is amazing.
Indeed. It's really amazing that this great rice in Senegal, we still are not consuming it. Its production is just limited in the south. It's called the Jola rice. And the Jola are consuming it because it has an important value spiritually. They use it for their sacred rituals. But the north, we still, 50 years after independence, we're still importing rice from Southeast Asia. You know, there's apparently some changes. The government is trying to promote local growing rice, but there's still so much work to be done. You know, it's political, of course, but it's mentality. People have to start really realizing how we have such great products and we have to really consume them.
Pierre, there's a word that you use a lot in the book, terenga.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you say in the title, the subtitle of the book is From the Source to the Bowl, not the Plate. Mm. So what's the – first of all, let's start with the bowl. What is the significance of the bowl in Senegal?
Well, the bowl is the vessel in which we eat, first of all. We eat around the bowl in Senegal, or in most of Africa, for that matter. The bowl symbolizes unity. We eat together. Eating is something that's not done in a separate way. In Senegal, you always stop everything when it's mealtime and everyone gets together. And the bowl is that magnet that unifies the family, that brings friends and family together. And you mentioned teranga. Teranga is the word that symbolizes Senegal the best, I think. You know, teranga is a Wolof word that would translate hospitality. But it's not the right way to translate teranga. Teranga is much more than just hospitality. It's the most important value. If there's a set of values in Senegal, teranga would be the most important one. It's the way you treat the guest. It's the way you treat the other, you know, the one who is not you. That person becomes the one you have to offer teranga. You have to treat him with so much respect. You have to offer him what you have. You have to invite him to sit around your bowl. There's always room for the other around your bowl. And why? Because we believe that the other is bringing blessings. So when you share your bowl will always be plentiful. This is the deep-rooted Senegalese belief. We believe that there's always more. You will never lack by sharing. Actually, when you share, you guarantee yourself that tomorrow there's going to be more food in your bowl. So this is a country that values the wealth of a person not by how much he has, but by how much he shares, by how much he gives. That's what I would say to summarize what teranga means. Teranga is what Senegal is. It's just this value has been encrusted in us that we have to treat the other as the most important person in the world.
What a difference that would make to the world.
Indeed.
Pierre, thank you. This has been a pleasure.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me, Lynn.
Pierre Cham is the author of Senegal, Modern Senegalese Recipes from the Source to the Bowl. Now, you can find more information on Senegal and his recipe for mango fonio salad on the website splendidtable.org. When sleeves-up dining is the goal, you need not look further than roadfood.com, the website started by Jane and Michael Stern, who, by the way, coined the term sleeves-up. Jane, Michael, good to have you guys back.
Great to be here, Lynn.
So what are the new thoughts, discoveries?
We've been traveling in the South, and one of the things we always look for in the South is really good pimento cheese. You know, having grown up in the Midwest, my knowledge of pimento cheese was those little glass craft jars that you get that you empty them and then they become, I guess, like a Drambuie glass once you clean them out.
Forgot about
the fact you remember
that's what I thought pimento cheese was. But in fact, you know, in the South, pimento cheese is one of the top sort of hostess dishes. At a party, you have to have pimento cheese, and there are all kinds of ways of doing it. Anyway, we were in Landrum.
Wait, I'm going to stop you, though.
Okay.
I think you've got to explain exactly what it is.
Pimento cheese is usually grated cheddar with some pimentos, which are, you know, of course, the blandest of all peppers, usually some mayonnaise, and then whatever you, as the cook, want to put into. You can have capers, you can have little bits of pickle, you can have olives, horseradish, you can spice it up.
And you make it into a nice festive cheese ball, which is one of the great food groups.
Well, it doesn't have to be a ball. It can also be a dip.
I love the ball.
But more important than ball and dip is what we want to talk about today, Lynn, which is the pimento cheeseburger. Back in the 1960s, so the story goes, there was a restaurateur in Columbia, South Carolina, a guy named J.C. Reynolds, who had a place called the Dairy Bar. And he came up with the bright idea of making cheeseburgers with pimento cheese on top. That has since become a favorite way to have cheeseburgers, not just in Columbia, South Carolina, Carolina in general, but you find them really throughout much of the South now. And it's a great thing, a great way to make a different kind of cheeseburger.
I can imagine that melting into a hot burger. That must just be, I mean, sloppy but delicious.
It is sloppy and delicious. And
do you want to give some of our favorite places we've found?
I'll tell you, the most recent find and a really favorite one is in a town called Landrum, South Carolina, just right near the North Carolina border out west. And what they do there is to take the pimento cheeseburger concept to a whole other level by topping the juice-laden meat patty not only with a very smoky kind of pimento cheese, but then bedding it on a couple of discs of crisp fried green tomato. And the crisp, pickly tomato combined with the beef and the creamy cheese and the brioche bun on which it all rests is one spectacular mouthful of food.
Yeah. Oh. And except for the brioche, it's probably the most southern thing you could ever imagine. Fried green tomatoes, pimento cheese.
What's the name of the place you have to go in that town?
It's called the Southside Smokehouse. So in fact, there's a whole other menu of really good barbecue. Get the ribs, get the pulled pork, but you got to get a cheeseburger as well.
And oh, so where else should we check out?
One other place that's really a fun restaurant in Columbia, South Carolina, is the Rockaway Athletic Club. And one of the fun things about this, they make a great kind of classic pimento cheeseburger with mayonnaise, mustard, lettuce, tomato, onion, pickle chips, all like piled into a bun. But one of the fun things about the Rockaway Athletic Club is that it has no sign at all outside. Everyone just knows where this place is.
Is it an athletic club? I could never figure that out.
I don't think so. I don't remember seeing any sweaty people walking
no,
around.
And eating cheeseburgers is my idea of sport.
Right.
So is there anywhere outside of the Carolinas?
You know, it's definitely not nearly as popular anywhere else as it is in South Carolina.
Ooh,
and
you know,
North Carolina.
What else you should put on your hamburger is, do you know what red slaw is, Lynn?
No.
Oh, yeah, if it's not messy enough.
It's coleslaw that you add a dollop or major dollop of barbecue sauce to.
Ah.
And so you put that as a layer over the fried green tomatoes. And
the
pimento cheese is on there, too?
Yeah. Okay. Could you die for that?
A multi-napkin meal.
Thank you, guys.
Bye, okay, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
You can find Jane and Michael Stern's road food picks at roadfood.com. And just in case you like to make your own pimento cheese, we have a classic take from Southern chef Frank Stitt. Find his recipe for Miss Verba's pimento cheese at splendidtable.org. Coming up, we open the lines for your calls and the difficulties of feeding an aging parent. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me.
We're taking your questions. Get to us any way you feel like it. Facebook, Twitter, send an email, splendidtable.org, or call us, 800-537-5252. Teresa's calling from Tucson, Arizona. Hey, Teresa, what's on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
Hi. I have a turkey just shy of 13 pounds sitting in my freezer, and I was wondering if I could butterfly this thing and cook it on my gas grill.
Absolutely you can. The trick is, you know, defrost it in the fridge.
Right.
Cut it down along the backbone, splay it out. And
right.
Yes, absolutely you can do it on the grill. But the real trick is going to be that you have to really cook it slow. And
right.
If you're going to do a marinade or a rub, nothing with sugar in it, because that's going to burn very quickly. You know, if you want a sweet, spicy glaze, brush that on toward the end of cooking.
Okay.
You're probably going to want to keep the grill at a medium low and, okay. You know, cover it up, cook it low. And then at the thickest part of the meat, which is often the breast, you want that to be at 165 on an instant reading thermometer.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's it. And you can, of course, flavor it any way you want. You can brine it, but it'll be great.
Okay. Well, I'm looking forward to it.
Hey, Teresa, enjoy the bird.
Will do.
Take care.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
By the way, probably everybody knows this, but sometimes the most logical things don't occur to us when we're in a very slight panic mode, as in, I don't have the time to cook the chicken I was going to cook, or the big thick steak I was going to cook, or the turkey. Meat cooks by density, by how thick it is, not how many pounds it is. It's how long it takes the heat to reach the center of whatever the meat is. So if you've got a huge thick steak and you have no time to cook it the way it should be cooked, butterfly it. Just cut it down the center, open it up like a book, or make it into two steaks, and then sear it really fast. And then cook it really, really, really slow, and it'll be juicy and wonderful. And the same is true, you know, for a chicken, for a roast even. Yes, you can slice a roast actually into little steaks. So just remember, make it thinner. It will cook faster. 800-537-5252. That's how you can reach us. And also, we're on Facebook and Twitter if you want to check us out. Anne is calling from Boston. Anne, what is on your mind?
Hi, Lynn. I'm so happy to talk to you.
Oh, good to talk to you, too.
I'm calling about fresh ginger.
Oh, okay.
It's at the local farmer's market almost every year. It's totally undried. It's got the stems and leaves all on it.
Oh.
I've only used it in a stir fry. I was wondering if you had suggestions for something special.
Well, as I'm talking to you, I'm drinking hot ginger tea.
Ooh.
Slice it up. A lot of it, you know, so I'd say you want about a quarter of a cup of just the sliced ginger to maybe 4 to 5 cups of boiling water. And what I do is you just put it in any kind of container, keep it hot, mm-hmm. Let it steep. That's if you want to drink it hot. And I'd say let it steep for about 15, 20 minutes. And I put just a little bit of agave syrup or sugar in it. And again, that's pure taste. But If you make it, let it steep for an hour or whatever until you get the flavor you like, the intensity that you like. Then you can chill it and you can serve it over ice with fresh mint and a little bit of lemon or lime. And then there's the classic. For me, there's whenever I have an urge for something with some spice and a little sprightliness, you know, not the kind of deep, rich flavors that we like in the winter, but very high, bright flavors. Into my little food processor goes probably the equivalent of 2 inches of a ginger root chopped, about 4 cloves of garlic, a serrano, which if you like it a little hotter, or a jalapeno chili that I've seeded. And maybe, again, if you don't like super hot, start out with a little bit of that chili and keep adding. And then I whirl that around. And then what I add to that is a little bit of sugar or honey, okay? And then throw in some fresh lime juice. And that can be rubbed over anything that doesn't move too fast, from eggplant to sautéed green beans. It's gone on sweet potatoes. Obviously, you know, all the animal family loves that kind of thing. And what's a great thing, too, is when you get it really pureed down and maybe add a little bit of fish sauce to it, that makes a wonderful dressing for noodles. Toss it with rice. It's fragrant and it's luscious and it's fresh and it's bright. Oh, and the other thing I often do with it is I toss it with fruit like melons. And it makes a salad.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah. And, you know, you then may fool around. You might add a little more lime. You might leave out the fish sauce and add it a little later. But anyway, that's one thing you can do with the ginger. The other thing that's wonderful is ginger and basil and garlic like each other a lot. And it's a wonderful seasoning. Ginger and citrus, especially like ginger and orange, wonderful flavors. Now, one of the things it's kind of fun to do is take a 10-ounce package of frozen pineapple chunks. Put those into a food processor. You want the juice of half a lime. You want maybe 2 teaspoons of sugar. And then you want to grate about a half inch of ginger root over that. And keep it frozen, puree it, okay, and immediately scoop it into bowls or whatever, and it's like eating ice cream. It is so refreshing, and it's so delicious. Ginger and fruit always works. And of course, you know, fresh ginger in an apple pie, fresh ginger in a custard pie, fresh ginger over bananas with cream. I mean, all of that. It's an incredible flavoring. And it can go in a lot of different ways.
Oh, wow. Okay. That sounds fantastic. I have a lot to work with.
Yes, you do. And thanks for a great question.
Oh, thank you. Have a lovely day.
You too, Anne. Bye.
Bye.
800-537-5252. And, of course, Facebook and Twitter. Poor Man's Feast food writer Elissa Altman grew up with a glamour puss of a mother. A high-heeled, dressed-to-the-nines, rail-thin, lipstick-mirror-checking kind of mother, who not only worried about her own weight, but took on her daughter's as well. Well, recently the tables have turned, as Elissa has been writing about in her Washington Post series, Feeding My Mother. Our managing producer, Sally Swift, got the story.
Hey, Elissa, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you are writing about how hard it can be to feed an aging parent.
This is correct.
So tell us about your mom.
My mom is a former television singer. She's a former model. She was a model as recently as 10 years ago. And she is just a beautiful lady and always has been and has a kind of funky relationship with food and always has had that. I grew up in a home where, you know, I used to say that my father divorced my mother because she was too religious. Every meal she made was a sacrifice or a burnt offering. And in truth, she, you know, it took me a while to understand, you know, that there are certain people who are just not good cooks and they don't get it and that's just the way it is. I wouldn't say that so much about her. She is fearful of food, and it's taken me a long time to come to understand that, and that there's a difference. In her life, food was the enemy. She herself refers to her herself as a child as being very heavy. I've seen pictures of her when she was four. I thought she was nine. And so I think that she's had a very cautious, difficult relationship with food, especially because she knew early on that she wanted to be on television. She wanted to be a singer. And that played itself out at the table.
So, Alyssa, what did she teach you about food when you were growing up?
My mother taught me that food was fuel, that food was dangerous, that food was the enemy, that it was certainly not something to be particularly proud of being emotionally involved with, although she herself is emotionally involved with it in a different way. And it's taken me a very long time to sort of unravel those lessons that she taught me.
Mm-hmm. It's just so poignant that, of course, that's the path you went down for your writing. You know, that's where your creative font comes from. It's wonderful, actually. You've carved yourself out another life, you know?
Well, you know, my dad used to say that I learned how to cook, and I started to write about food and cooking out of self-preservation. And so I think that he was probably right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Are you surprised at this turn of events right now about you having this battle with her to eat, essentially?
You know, I think that there are a lot of us who are all sort of in the same age group, and we all sort of have aging and older parents. And what I'm hearing from a lot of my friends and colleagues is the same kind of thing, similar problems. You know, mom won't eat, so I'm giving her Ensure. Mom was eating the wrong thing. She's eating too much of the wrong thing. With me, you know, I'm able to go there. She lives in Manhattan. I'm able to cook for her on a regular basis. I'm able to take her out, which she loves. But she just doesn't really particularly like to eat. She's very, very wary of her plate. And so she's really a quintessential New Yorker. She adores to walk. She loves the city. But, of course, at this point, when she walks into a doctor's office, you know, then one of the questions that invariably comes up is what do you eat? And, you know, if I'm not there, she'll tell them, you know, I'll have chicken, I'll have vegetables. Well, she's not telling them that she's having a sliver of chicken and a Brussels sprout, mm-hmm. period. You know, I've tried to explain to her that the better her diet, the more she can walk, the longer she can walk across Manhattan and the longer she can be active. And I think she understands that, mm-hmm. but actually putting that to work doesn't really happen mm-hmm. so well.
Well, and philosophically, it's interesting because, you know, I mean, it is her life. She has lived this way all these many years, and suddenly you are thrust in this position where, you know, not a particularly comfortable one for you, I would think.
No, it's, you know, it's difficult. And when I wrote my first piece for the Washington Post about this, there were a lot of people responded and said, you know, exactly what you just said. You know, it's her life. She's lived this way her whole life. You know, why do you think that she's going to change? Why do you think she should change? And of course, I want her to be as healthy for as long mm-hmm. as she can possibly be healthy. But again, you know, she's got that image of herself lodged in her brain as, you know, a heavy child, as she put it, and that's where the challenge is.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because I think that there is something about that generation of women that have, well, I mean, women in general can have a very difficult relationship with food, but there's something about that age of woman. I mean, my mother used to brag that, you know, she never gained more than 10 pounds with any of her four daughters when she was pregnant.
Right. You right. Know? Yeah, that sounds very familiar. I mean, I wrote a post called Infrequent Potatoes and the fact that my mother did not know she was pregnant for 6 months. And it took one of her teenage nieces to say, you know, maybe. She was like, I'm gaining weight and I have no idea why. And then she finally went to the doctor when she couldn't get her rings off. And, you know, that's classic. And when I was born, I was born at 4 pounds, which is, you know, roughly, for context, the size of a supermarket chicken. And,
yes, it is.
You know, and I'm not like that anymore. I favor my father's side of the family physically, which is the sort of short and not statuesque live side. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of hard for her, too.
Mm-hmm. Alyssa, thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Alyssa Altman is the author of Poor Man's Feast, a love story of comfort, desire, and the art of simple cooking. You can find her recipe for grill-roasted chicken with tarragon and garlic at splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. See you here next week. And in the meantime, let me leave you with this thought from Jim Feiberg. Age does not diminish the extreme disappointment of having a scoop of ice cream fall from the cone. SplendidTable.org has just about everything you're ever going to need. And if you like what you heard today, be sure to subscribe to our podcast on your favorite podcast app. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Courtney McEwen. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lukey. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thanks for tuning in. You have a great week. I'm Lynn Rossetto Castro, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.